morning. It gives me immense pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Professor C.V. Sundaram, who will be speaking on the power of the atom. Currently, he is Homi Bhabha visiting professor of this institute. Professor Sundaram is a metallurgist who has made important contributions in the field of extractive metallurgy of rare metals. He had been associated with the Indian Atomic Energy Program since 1956. During the period 1975 to 1982, he was the head of the metallurgy division of the Bhabha Atomic Research Center. And during 1982 to 1989, he was the director of the Indira Gandhi Center for Atomic Research at Kalpakkam. Professor Sundaram and his group have been responsible for ushering an era of production of rare, reactive and refractory metals with indigenous capabilities and expertise with important consequences for the development of the atomic energy program. As director of the Indira Gandhi Center for Atomic Research, Professor Sundaram's major mission was on commissioning of the first breeder test reactor. Professor Sundaram was president of the Indian Institute of Metal for the year 1981-82, and during 1991-93, he was the president of the Indian Nuclear Society. He is editor of the journal Metals, Materials and Processes. He is a fellow of the Indian National Science Academy, the Indian Academy of Sciences and Indian National Academy of Engineering. Professor Sundaram is a recipient of Platinum Jubilee Award of the Indian Institute of Science in 1984, the Indian Institute of Metal Platinum Medal in 1985, and the S.H. Jahir Medal Award of INSA in 1986. Government of India honored Professor Sundaram with Padma Bhushan in 1986. Professor Sundaram's present interests at NIA: energy options, environmental issues and advanced materials development. Ladies and gentlemen, may I now invite Professor Sundaram to deliver his talk.
Thank you, Dr. Shetty, fellow participants in this course, friends and colleagues. I think in the course of the last 1 week and more, I've had the pleasure, the enjoyment of listening to many of you, and I have benefited from listening to the presentations that you have made on a variety of subjects. And this morning, I think it is my turn to make a presentation. I should say at the outset that the title for this morning's talk has been assigned to me by Professor Sen. In fact, on this same forum, I have had the opportunity to talk about nuclear power, the positive aspects of atomic energy. I have also spoken on the atomic bomb and its military and political implications. I think this is the first time I am taking on the total subject of the power of the atom. This year, 1996, happens to be the centenary year of the discovery of radioactivity. Radioactivity as a new phenomenon was discovered by Henry Becquerel in 1896. The year before, in 1895, Rontgen had discovered X-rays. And in 1897, Thomson discovered the electron. So those three epoch-making discoveries set up a cascade of other discoveries. I think in the early part of the century, we had the further discovery of the proton as a result of the work of Rutherford at Cavendish in England. And in 1932, the important particle neutron, which had been anticipated, was discovered by Chadwick, also in England. And this cascade ultimately culminated in the discovery of nuclear fission, the fission of the uranium nucleus in 1938. Till then, though the details of subatomic and subnuclear structure were getting unfolded, no one had really anticipated that nuclear fission was possible. As I will mention later, Enrico Fermi, who was doing a series of experiments in the University of Rome on the reaction of neutrons with a whole range of elements. In fact, when he took up the experiment with uranium, he was looking for an element beyond uranium. And he had even felt he had discovered it at that time, though that discovery came later. So the results that were first obtained with the fission of with the reaction of uranium and a neutron were not immediately interpreted, and it fell to Hahn and Strassmann in Berlin to finally discover the important event of the fission of the uranium nucleus when it is bombarded with a neutron. This got published early in 1939. I think this young audience, I don't think anyone was born at that time. I happened to be a school student, and certainly it was not clear to me, it was not known to me what was happening. And my first exposure to the enormous possibility of atomic energy was when the dropping of the atom bomb was announced in August 1945, in the closing stages of the war. Now, since 1939, and certainly since the 1940s, the subject of atomic energy has dominated the world scene in a variety of ways. And that will be the subject of today's talk. Now, when you talk about the power of the atom, there are various facets to this subject. I think to some extent Dr. Deepavalapalli referred to the military and political power that has come to be associated with the possession of nuclear weapons. And then even from the earliest days, certainly soon after the war, the possibility of producing electricity from nuclear fission energy was realized. So today there are at least about 430 reactors, power reactors operating in 30 different countries with an installed capacity of about 350,000 megawatts. So nuclear energy has come to be established as an important source of electricity. And as we look to the foreseeable future, the nuclear reactor can also be a source of process heat. It can be used for desalination, for example. It has been used in transportation for propulsion of submarines. And it has been suggested that in the upper stages of space rockets, you can use the thermal heat from nuclear reactors. Then when we talk of the power of the atom, one other important aspect, which has been well established in our own atomic energy program, is the beneficial use to which we can put atomic radiation, nuclear radiation. In the Baba Atomic Research Center today, we have got a board of research in the technology of radiation and isotopes. It is extensively used for medical diagnosis. It is used in agriculture to produce new mutations. It can be used for the sterilization of medical products, as radioactive isotopes can be used as tracers. Apart from being sources of radiation, they are used in industry, and also in an important way in food irradiation, which has come to be accepted. So in my talk, I will devote definitely time to the military and political power of atomic energy. And also spend the sufficient time on nuclear electricity, and perhaps I'll have a little time to talk about radioisotopes. You have already had two lectures on the origin of man, and later on you are going to have lectures on the origin of the universe. This particular slide I have taken from one issue of the Scientific American in October 1994. The entire issue is devoted to life in the universe. And there are many interesting chapters there on the origin of the universe, and the origin of chemical elements in the universe, then the development of Earth's geology, then the incidence of life on Earth, and finally the development of mind and consciousness. Now this slide schematically represents the relative abundance of elements in the universe. Early enough in the history of the universe, the element hydrogen was formed. And today we know, and it was known even before the discovery of nuclear fission, that hydrogen is the fuel in the burning of stars, and the energy is largely derived when hydrogen nuclei combine to form helium nuclei. Now, in the steady burning of the stars, in stellar burning, you also have the phenomenon of what we call nucleosynthesis, where relatively light nuclei combine to form a heavier nuclei. And this proceeds all the way to elements like iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, and zinc, all of them formed in the environment, the high temperature environment of stars, through the process of nucleosynthesis. Now that is about the limit of highest stability that you get in nuclei, and the elements that are formed beyond this, under the special conditions when stars explode or there are supernova explosions. Apart from the conditions of high temperature, there are also conditions of shock waves. Then heavier elements have formed. You see, today in natural occurrence, you have elements as many as 92, almost 92, starting with hydrogen being the lightest and uranium being the heaviest naturally occurring element. Man has been able to synthesize in 1940 new elements, another 16 or more, which are called the transuranic elements. But elements up to uranium beyond zinc here form under very special conditions when stars explode. And there are situations of shock waves. That's the understanding. And the relative abundance of those elements is much smaller than the abundance that is presented here of the relatively lighter elements. For example, for every 100 billion atoms of hydrogen that we have in the universe, there is only one atom of uranium. So that's the relative scarcity of the heavier elements. This again is a schematic representation where we compare the relative stability measured by the binding energy per nuclear particle in the nucleus. You have a certain distribution starting from hydrogen again up to uranium. And as I already mentioned, the stablest nuclei are in the mass number region, somewhere around 56 or 60, corresponding to iron. So this gives us the possibility that in the lower range of nuclei, the lighter nuclei, when lighter nuclei combine to form heavier nuclei, there will be a release of energy which you call fusion energy. So the source of energy that you have in stellar burning is the fusion energy derived from the fusion of hydrogen to helium, four nuclei combining to one nucleus of helium. At the other end, again, we have a relatively unstable nucleus. And here, this nucleus can be disturbed, as was discovered in 1938, when it reacts with a neutron. The whole system breaks up, and you form lighter elements, up this curve, and again with the release of energy. So at one end, you have fusion of nuclei that give rise to energy. At the other end, fission of nuclei that give rise to energy. So we have got, with respect to nuclear energy, two possibilities. One of fusion energy and another of fission energy. Now the fission reaction is written here. You are familiar with the way chemical reactions are written here. The participants are nuclei or nuclear particles. Now uranium-235 is one of the naturally occurring isotopes of uranium. The word isotope is used to describe atoms of the same chemical element differing in atomic weight. For example, uranium-235 is an isotope of uranium. Uranium-238 is also an isotope of uranium. And the difference between the two lies only in the nuclear structure. There's a difference in the number of neutrons between uranium-235 and uranium-238. I'll come back to that. Now, when uranium-235, this represents the mass of the uranium atom, also the number of nucleons present in the uranium isotope. When it reacts with a neutron, the nucleus becomes unstable. It breaks up into two new elements, both lighter than uranium, barium and krypton. And the important associated fact is three neutrons are emitted in the process. And as the total mass on the right-hand side is slightly less than the mass on the left-hand side, there is a release in energy. Because the electron volt is a unit of energy, the same way Erg is a unit of energy or calorie is a unit of energy. I will not at this stage convert this into calories or kilowatt hours. The important fact for you to see is the heavy nucleus disturbed by a neutron breaks into two lighter nuclei with the emission of neutrons and also release of energy. Now this is only one way in which the uranium nucleus can be. There are many other, all possible ways are there, but the predominant reaction is in the neighborhood of the masses 140 and 90. This is also a pictorial representation of the fission, the uranium nucleus. This is the unstable state. It is in the incipient stage of fission, and finally it breaks up. Now, the associated feature in this fission is the simultaneous emission of neutrons. And soon after the discovery of fission, it was also recognized that this simultaneous emission of neutrons gives us the possibility of what we call a chain reaction. Now, the incident neutron, the first one, breaks the first nucleus. And if you get at least two more neutrons, the average is between 2 and 3. In some cases it is 2, in some cases it is 3. At least two neutrons are emitted simultaneously with fission. Then these two, if available, can induce fission in two more nuclei. And these two fissions will give rise to 4 neutrons. So the next generation will be 8 neutrons. So you proceed very rapidly from the fission of one nucleus in the first generation to two in the second generation to 4 and so on. And the amazing fact of the bomb lies in the fact this successive generation, which goes in a geometric progression, 2 squared, 2 cubed on, takes place in a time frame of a millionth of a second. Now, if you express that atomic mass in grams, which is called the gram atom of uranium, 235 grams of uranium, it contains as many as 6 times 10 to the power of 23 atoms. Now, this is an exponential factor, 1 followed by 23 zeros. So that is the population of uranium atoms in 235 grams, or if you consider 1 kilogram, it will be about 4 times that. It will be 2 times trillion atoms. It's an astronomical number. Now, when in the pattern or in the scheme I represented in the earlier figure, you have successive generation of neutrons and fissions happening in this mass of uranium. You can have from the total fission of all the nuclei in 1 kilogram, 25 million kilowatt hours of energy. That is the energy released from 1 kilogram. Now, to get some idea, if you have a 40 watt electric bulb and it burns for one day, it will be somewhat equivalent to 1 kilowatt hour of energy. Now imagine 25 million such bulbs burning. They will release this much in one day. But if you telescope this to a millionth of a second, you can see the enormous deposition of energy that that can take place in a situation where 1 kilogram of uranium-235 reacts completely to undergo fission in the fraction or in a millionth of a second. Now, this was what was observed after the initial prediction and the project work that was done in the United States when they first tested the first atom bomb in the New Mexican desert in July 1945. Till then, I don't think anybody has experienced any such phenomenon. And this much of energy, when that atom bomb was exploded, was released in about 1,000 millionths of a second, that is 1,000th of a second, creating a temperature of tens of millions of degrees and a pressure of millions of pounds. And that was an experience. Whoever witnessed it it was easy for them to say that we have not witnessed anything like a spectacle, anything like this before. And they were totally rattled by what they saw. Now, simultaneous with that possibility, where you can explode a few kilograms of uranium-235 and generate, deposit all that energy in a small space of time, there is also all those fission products that are released in that fission. Many of them or all of them are radioactive. I'll draw your attention, for example, to strontium-90, which is one of the fission products. It's a beta ray emitter, which has a half-life of 28 years. Cesium, another radioisotope. Iodine-131, another radioisotope. All of them can remain substantially radioactive for places anywhere between days and years. Now, what we have to reckon with here is that, for example, iodine-131 is a chemical that can get preferentially absorbed in the thyroid of the human system. Strontium or barium, if it is ingested into the human system, can concentrate in the bone, and all these sources of radiation can contribute to the development of cancer. So this is the fear that we know that is associated with radioactivity. Now, before I leave the subject at this stage, I will also make a reference to this reaction. I've talked about it before. This is the fusion reaction where an isotope of hydrogen with a mass 2 can react with another nucleus of the same mass to form a third isotope of hydrogen with release of energy, or an isotope of hydrogen can react with a third isotope with a mass 3. This is called deuterium, this is called tritium, can form a helium nucleus with the liberation of a neutron. Here again, there is a release of energy. So these are possible fusion reactions, which can also be harnessed for generating energy. But these reactions, unlike in the case of fission, which can be induced at room temperature, these reactions take place only at a temperature of 100 million degrees. These reactions take place, for example, only in the environment of the stars. So today, if you want to duplicate these reactions in a terrestrial environment, you have to have a situation where you generate those temperatures, And one way of doing it is, you can have a fission bomb to produce that temperature, and the thermonuclear reaction can be triggered in the same process. But of course, the name of Albert Einstein is associated with nuclear energy and even the atom bomb in more ways than one. He is famous for his equation E as energy is equal to mass times the square of the velocity of light, E equals mc squared. This was a relationship derived from him, his theory of relativity. But the first spectacular demonstration of this relationship came in the form of the atom bomb test in 1945. Now, Einstein, who became a victim of the anti-Jewish policy of Hitler in the 30s, he migrated and settled in the United States at the Princeton University, and it was Niels Bohr, who was referred yesterday in the treatment of quantum mechanics, the famous Danish scientist, who took the news of the discovery of nuclear fission from Europe to the United States. And the importance of that discovery was recognized by all the nuclear physicists there. And they also immediately recognized that there is a distinct possibility that this reaction can be used to build a bomb. And the anxiety was that the Allied powers to develop it earlier than Hitler's Nazi Germany. So they came to a conclusion that a letter should be written to President Roosevelt. President Roosevelt was the President of the United States in the 30s. And they felt that if this letter proceeds from a personality like Einstein, it will carry weight. And they drafted a letter to alert President Roosevelt, and this letter was signed by Albert Einstein, and it was given to President Roosevelt to set in motion a program for the development of fission energy and eventually to the possibility of the development of the bomb ahead of Nazi Germany. Now, before I leave the subject of these two eminent personalities, I must mention that though Einstein's letter was instrumental in setting in motion the process of the project, after that he was kept away from the project. I don't think he came to know any details of the technology of the development of the atom bomb. At some stage during his life in Germany, he had some association and some sympathy for the communist movement, so he was kept under watch during the period of the war. And he was kept totally away from the details of the atom project. And later on, when the bomb was dropped, of course, it was a period of hard searching for all the scientists who had participated in the project. But Einstein took upon himself the mission that soon enough, this awesome source of energy and power should be placed under international control. So in the latter part of his life, he died in 55, he was a campaigner for the international control of the bomb. he couldn't succeed. And similarly, Niels Bohr, though he was instrumental in alerting the Western scientists and also instrumental in drafting that letter to President Roosevelt, as the war was progressing and it was clear that Nazi Germany was not anywhere near the development of the atom bomb, he felt that for the future peace of the world, it had become necessary that the secrets of the atom bomb project should be shared with the Soviet Union. He took the initiative of meeting, for example, Winston Churchill in London to tell him that the time has come to take the Soviet Union into confidence. But Churchill had entirely different viewpoints on world history and world politics. He felt that Bohr is again a person to be watched, and Niels Bohr was kept under watch for the period of the war. I'll show also a picture of Enrico Fermi, I had mentioned about the work he had done on the reaction of neutrons with various chemical elements. Fermi also migrated to the United States because Mussolini's Italy was again a fascist country where Jews were not popular. Fermi's wife was a Jew, and together they migrated to the United States before the outbreak of the war. He settled in the University of Columbia, and he set up a program on reactor physics there. And during the war, after the commencement of the atom bomb project, he was the leader for setting up the first man-made nuclear reactor in the campus of Chicago, and that reactor attained criticality. It was commissioned in December 1942. If the idea of nuclear fission could be pursued to the development of a reactor and a bomb, it also depended on a concentration of scientific talent that had happened in the United States because of the migration of talent from Europe. Many outstanding scientists from Germany, Hungary, and other places had migrated. And the project set in motion in 1939, which gathered momentum in 1941, came to a head in July 1945 with the explosion of the first test bomb. Now, as this bomb project was progressing, and it was getting clear that success may be achieved, there was an anxiety on the part of the participating scientists that by the time they test the bomb, perhaps they can call neutral observers to the test site so that they can see the magnitude of the explosion and also act as messengers to the Japanese to force them to surrender. Because after the close of war on the European front by April 1945, Japan was still fighting bitterly. And the Western powers were not sure how long the war may last on the Pacific front. And so the suggestion was that after the test, a message could be communicated through neutral observers to the Japanese on the possession of this mighty power on the part of the Allies. But that was not accepted. All the information relating to the project lay largely in the preserve of the United States, and the bomb was tested in July 1945 in the New Mexican desert. And here we see the picture of Robert Oppenheimer, who was the director of the Los Alamos laboratory where the bomb effort was brought to a head, and that is General Groves, who coordinated the activity across the United States. It was a billion-dollar project even at that point in time, which required the setting up of a variety of facilities in places like Hanford in Washington, in Chicago, in Oak Ridge, and so on. And General Groves' responsibility was to involve the right people and bring it to a head in good time. And even after the test, there was some discussion what should be the next action, how the bomb should be used, if at all it is to be used against Japan, whether a warning should be given or a demonstration should be given over the Tokyo Bay. But finally, the decision was taken that bomb should be dropped on populated centers without any warning. Because the fact of the matter is, after one bomb was tested, at that time there were only two more bombs of different designs, and there was an anxiety they should be used without this stage of any warning, and also in such a way the participants will get a good measure of the damage that the bomb can cause. Now, before I describe the atom bombing of Hiroshima, I should give to you also this description. This is as recorded by one of the scientists, Italian scientists, who watched the first test. And all these people knew the possibility of success. They were not absolutely sure. They were not sure of the yield from the bomb. But they had stationed themselves 2 miles away from the bomb tower. And this is what Emilio Segre records when the bomb went off on the early morning of July 16, 1945. The most striking impression was that of an overwhelmingly bright light. I was flabbergasted by the new spectacle. We saw the whole sky flash with unbelievable brightness in spite of the dark glasses we wore. For a moment, I thought the explosion might set fire to the atmosphere and finish the earth, even though they had done calculations to know that such a conflagration setting the earth on fire was not possible. So that they were stunned. Now, Oppenheimer himself was watching it from a bunker, and certainly he was anxious. He said, we waited until the blast, because after the brightness of a thousand suns, there was the shock wave, it passed. He comes out of the shelter. He says the atmosphere was extremely solemn. We knew that the world will not be the same. A few of us laughed, a few cried, but most people were silent. And lastly, Weisskopf remembers, our first feeling was one of elation. Then we realized we were tired, because they had worked on it for months, and then we were worried. So you can see the first reactions of the scientists. So when I read those records, what troubles me is, how did these same scientists who were stunned by what they saw, who knew the magnitude of that explosion, still give the clearance, because there was one more discussion, to drop two bombs on populated cities without warning and at a time of the day when many people were out. Because this is a disturbing thought, but I think they were carried away by what Oppenheimer later called in a different context, the technically sweet aspect of testing a technological idea. I mean, they didn't realize the actual monstrosity of it. Because Oppenheimer is also credited with this recollection. There is a book called Brighter Than a Thousand Suns. The title of that is drawn from a verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Oppenheimer was also a Sanskrit scholar. He had read the Bhagavad Gita, and in the chapter on the Vishwarupa Darsana, where Krishna is supposed to reveal his real form, the sloka says, if the splendor of a thousand suns were to rise at once in the sky, that would be like the splendor of that mighty one. And many of the Oppenheimer imagined that, in fact, a thousand suns had burst in that bomb. He also recalls what Krishna says, at that moment I have become death, the destroyer of the worlds. The death-dealing aspect also is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. Anyway, the bomb was dropped without warning. That was 3 weeks later over Hiroshima. Now, that was early morning, 8:15 in the morning, and that bomb was a uranium bomb. Well, the one that had been tested in the desert earlier was a plutonium bomb. It was dropped about 2,000 feet above ground level. And the plane that dropped had been advised the precaution that soon after dropping, its height should be some 10 miles. All the crew of the plane were advised to wear goggles. They were advised not to see the explosion as it happened, though some of them did, took photographs. But they were advised to stay at a height of 10 miles by the time the bomb exploded, while the bomb exploded over the city at a height of half a mile. So it flattened 4 square miles. It is converted it into an immediate crematorium. Out of a population of 3,43,000, 78,000 died and 40,000 were terribly burnt. A similar number succumbed to radiation sickness in the following months, and many developed cancer in subsequent years. And the mechanical damage, 76,000 buildings, 48 were completely destroyed, and another 22,000 severely damaged. Now, the people who survived in that 4 square miles were those who happened to be inside buildings, because the concrete gave them a protection. or who are on a side where the building itself was giving them a protection. Because I have distributed to you an article on Hiroshima, and I have gone into details there. Now I don't have time, but it is not just the number. The trauma through which the surviving population went, I have listed in para 2. You can read it at leisure. Now, I mentioned about two types of bombs. The one that was tested first is the plutonium bomb, which was dropped on Nagasaki. That was the second target. Here, you start with a sphere of plutonium, which by itself is in a subcritical condition. You know, if neutrons are to be the agents for fission, then you must have a continuous supply of neutrons for a chain reaction. But in a subcritical mass, even though there may be a few stray neutrons, there is no sustained chain reaction. But you create a critical mass by surrounding this with chemical explosive, and when the chemical explosive is triggered, a forward spherical shock wave travels, and this plutonium sphere is compressed like this. Then it increases twice in density, and that becomes a critical mass situation, and that is when it explodes. So all this happens in a time space of about a millionth of a second. Some 80 generations of nuclear fissions take place, depositing all that energy. Then it comes out. The crucial thing is, until that much of deposition takes place, the inward shock wave keeps the mass in place. The other approach is, you have the critical mass in two separate halves. This is called the gun technique. Here again you have an explosive which drives one half into the other, which acts as a gun, and the entire thing is shielded in heavy metal. And this was the design that was used in the Hiroshima bomb. This was a uranium bomb and a plutonium bomb. One is called a gun device, and another one is called an implosion device. It's just a matter of detail. And this picture shows what I mentioned earlier. Within a radius of 2 kilometers, the destruction was complete, and the structural damage even extended up to 4 kilometers. This is how the familiar mushroom cloud looked like after the bombing of Nagasaki. It rose to a height of 5 miles. Now, we were discussing the justification of the bomb, even after knowing its diabolic nature. Winston Churchill, later on, recollecting the bomb, the choice of the decision to bomb, he has given his judgment. According to the achievement of the bomb was to avert a vast indefinite butchery. The estimate was if you don't use the bomb, and if you are going to conclude the war by conventional landing through the Japanese islands, they were afraid of the bitter resistance by the Japanese, and one estimate was at least 50,000 American soldiers will be killed if you have to go through a conventional end to the war by landing on the Japanese islands. So here he says the bomb averted a vast indefinite butchery. To bring the war to an end, to give the peace to the world, to lay healing hands upon its tortured peoples, that's on the Allied side, by a manifestation of overwhelming power at the cost of a few explosions, seemed after all our toils and perils a miracle of deliverance. So this is the Western, even today, I think last year, there were a series of programs on BBC reflecting on that decision. Even scientists said it was not a barbarous activity. It was not a barbarous act. For example, before the atom bombing of Hiroshima, they had carpet bombed Tokyo. And as many as 1 lakh lives had been lost in Tokyo, but by chemical bombing. He said so for to the the people fighting the war, the atom bomb was described as just another weapon. It was not a weapon of a different degree. But as I said, it was not just the loss of life that happened at that instant, but the surviving population and the horrors that they went through. I mean, you have to read a book by John Hersey, a small book called Hiroshima, where he has interviewed some six people who survived. Now, I don't have much time. I'm going to only flash one more before I take on the other subject. August 6th was the bombing, 1945 was Hiroshima, and August 9th Nagasaki. The U.S. Continued its testing in a bigger way through the late 40s. Soon after the success of the test and the bomb, at least a feeling among the section of the American administration was it will take years for the Soviet Union to succeed in producing a bomb. But the Soviet scientific base was sufficiently advanced, and as soon as Stalin heard about the bombing of Hiroshima, he knew that the balance of power had shifted to the United States, and he wanted to restore the balance. He advised his team of scientists led by Kurchatov to produce the bomb. And whereas at one stage an estimate was it may take 20 years for the Soviet Union to produce it, in 4 years Russia tested its first atom bomb. Then even side by side with the development of the uranium bomb, scientists knew you can develop the hydrogen bomb because you have now a trigger available. And the United States tested the first hydrogen bomb in 52. But within a year of that, the Soviets developed the hydrogen. That is, the time gap was reduced to 1 year for the hydrogen bomb, where it was 4 years from the start from almost scratch. Then we have had tests by the United Kingdom in 57 of the hydrogen bomb, the French nuclear test in 60. The Chinese joined the race in 64, and the Chinese produced their hydrogen bomb in 67. And India's only test to date program was in 74. I'll give you an idea of the size of these bombs before I leave the subject. Now the explosive power that is given here is in kilotons or thousands of tons of chemical explosive. Supposing you didn't have the atom bomb, you have to have 15,000 tons of TNT or any chemical explosive to produce the same explosive effect. So that was in the Hiroshima bomb, larger in Nagasaki. The first Russian bomb was of a similar size. The Indian test also was of a similar size. But when they went over to the fusion bombs, you can see the monstrous size of the explosive power. One of the first hydrogen bombs to be tested in the United States in one of the Pacific Islands was 10 million tons of explosive. That is about 500 times the Nagasaki bomb. The 15 million ton one was 1,000 times as destructive as Hiroshima. While we have already seen what the Hiroshima bomb had done, and there was no limit to the size of the hydrogen bomb. It depends on the amount of material they had to put in. And by 61, the Soviets had tested a 58 million ton bomb. I will not immediately discuss the way the Cold War contributed to a mounting up of those arsenals, but that gives you a trend of the build-up. Now, these are the pictures of the two Soviet scientists, Kurchatov, the senior one, and Sakharov, who led the atom bomb projects in the Soviet Union. Lastly, it was not just the development of the bombs. They had to have delivery systems to see that these bombs are aimed at targets and they can be delivered over long distances. The first bombs were carried by aircraft, and subsequently we have had nuclear submarines, and strategic ballistic missiles. These were called the three arms of the delivery system, bomber aircraft, intercontinental missiles, and nuclear submarines. And the stockpiles grew to an astronomical number of 32,000 on the US side, 33,000 on the Soviet side. So there was a mad race, because there was an atmosphere where neither side wanted to be taken by surprise, and if attacked by surprise, they wanted to have a massive retaliatory capability. I think a very nominal reduction in that stockpile has been agreed to more recently through discussions in what are called strategic arms reduction talks. And in 1991, in an agreement between George Bush and Gorbachev, they agreed to reduce the arsenal from 11,000 to 8,000 and from 12,000 to 10,000. What K. Subramaniam says, from one astronomical number to. And once Carl Sagan was commenting on, who is a pacifist, he said, how much money has been spent on the Cold War since 1945? I'll give you the figures for the United States. The figures for the Soviet Union should be comparable. If you add up all the expenditures from 1945, the answer will be $10 trillion, he said, at 1988 dollars. And what could you buy with the $10 trillion? He says the answer is everything in the United States can be bought except the land. So that is the amount. He goes on to list what they are. So that gives you an idea of defense expenditure during the Cold War. Can we have the slides? I will rapidly cover now the less spectacular but more satisfying aspect of nuclear energy, that is, how can we derive useful energy. Now, when you look at the energy scene, we have various sources for producing electricity. You are familiar with hydel energy. For example, when 1 kilogram of water falls to a height of 100 meters, the amount of energy it can produce is a minuscule, less than a thousandth of a unit. On the other hand, when you burn 1 kilogram of coal, you can derive 7 kilowatt hours. Similarly, 1 kilogram of gasoline will get 12 units of energy. Much more than what you get from a similar weight of water. They say there is a factor of a million when you go by weight, when you go from water power to coal power. And when you come to uranium-235, from 1 kilogram, you can produce 25 million units. So the weight-wise requirement of fuel in a nuclear power station is 3 million times smaller compared to a coal station. Today, you know, you have to transport coal over long distances. To operate a 1,000 megawatt station, you need about 3 million tons of coal to be transported per year, while the amount of uranium you have to transport is about 100 tons. You can carry one in trucks and the other one by wagon loads. And when you come to fusion power, you have a further advantage of about a factor of 7. So this is visualized as an ultimate inexhaustible source of energy for mankind, because you have hydrogen in the oceans. The heavy hydrogen is about 150 parts per million in the ocean, and if you can harness fusion energy, it's even more compact and concentrated than uranium energy. Next one, please. Now, I mentioned about the spread of nuclear power stations. Started somewhere in 1960, when the total contribution of nuclear power was about 0.1%. Today, by the 90s, it has gone to about 18%. Roughly, coal, gasoline, and gas, they contribute about 62% of electricity in the world. Then you have another 18 or so, or 20 from hydel energy, and 17% is contributed by nuclear. The contribution by the so-called renewables like solar, wind, and tidal is very small, less than, definitely less than 1%. There are projections made how it is going to increase because of various factors I might mention. It may remain static. Can we have the previous slide? See, while it has been increasing rapidly in the 80s, it has flattened a bit here, mainly because of the two accidents that happened, one in the United States and the other in the Soviet Union, the Three Mile Island accident and the Chernobyl accident, whereby the public lost some confidence in the safety of nuclear power. There was also the associated fear from the effects of radiation. So from the mid-80s, the Chernobyl accident was in 1986, the Three Mile Island accident in 1979, there has been a flattening of the curve. Next slide. And so it may stay so, that's one possibility. But if the pressure for increased energy demand overrides, and if we become more anxious about the adverse effects of coal burning, such as the greenhouse effect, there is a possibility that this 350 can go even to 450. It depends totally on public acceptance of nuclear energy. Next one. This is illustrative of the type of reactor that we have in our atomic power stations in Rajasthan, in Madras, in Narora and Kota. This is a very controlled way of harnessing the energy. I mentioned how in the millionth of a second you can explode 1 kilogram of uranium-235, but in such a reactor that 1 kilogram will burn over a period of 2 days, much more slowly. Then you don't have a single mass of the fuel here. It is a split up loading where you have a number of fuel bundles that are loaded into the channels in this reactor, and that split up loading gives us the possibility of extracting the heat as it is produced. Our interest is to burn it in such a way that you will raise the temperature of water to the boiling temperature, and steam can be made use of to run the turbines. Here you have got a stainless steel vessel where we hold heavy water as a moderator. There are some 300 channels running the length of this vessel, inside which we charge the nuclear fuel and through which we circulate cooling water. Next slide. Example, these are the types of fuel bundles that are used in these reactors. And they are all metal tubes inside which we put uranium oxide pellets. Now these are small pellets where the fission fragments that you saw in an earlier slide, when they pass through the solid lattice, they deposit energy as heat. And then if you have cooling water running the outside of these bundles, that heat is extracted away. So continuously these bundles are kept relatively cold, not more than 300 degrees. And that is the temperature to which the water is heated at a pressure of about 1500 psi. Next slide. This shows an exploded view of those tubes. That is the outer tube, and those are the pellets that are loaded into this and end cap welded, and you form a bundle of 19 such tubes. Around this you circulate the cooling water. Next slide. And this is the total arrangement of the reactor. You saw the reactor vessel. It is encased in a concrete structure to shield the personnel from radiation, and the pressurized hot water that comes from these coolant tubes then is conveyed to the boiler system, where there is a heat exchange between the pressurized water and the light water steam circuit. And from the boilers, the steam is conveyed to the turbine that turns and produces electricity. So you have got a source of nuclear heat, a heat transfer system that produces steam at high pressure and a temperature of 300 degrees. And that steam runs the turbine. So this is a different way of producing steam for producing electricity. Now, an important feature in this design is what we call the containment building. For example, this is a source of radioactivity because of the fission fragments that are produced in fission. Then, as the cooling water comes out, there is the off chance of some contamination in that cooling water. So this part also is kept contained. The idea of a containment building in concrete is In the event of any rupture of this system and this enclosure, the radioactivity will be fully contained in the containment building. There won't be any dispersal of radioactivity outside. And then the radioactivity can be washed down and treated separately. So that containment building is an essential feature of all reactors all over the world, and it was not there in the Chernobyl reactor. So that when there was a failure, the reactor was open to the sky, and there was a spewing of radioactive fission products up the sky and over Europe. So a containment building now is recognized as an important safety factor. Next slide. Feature. Now this illustrates, I was mentioning about the containment building. You've got the fuel pellet, and then the fuel cladding, that is the outer tube, then the heat transport system, then one containment, two containment. So there are multiple barriers in the engineered structure to ensure that even if there is the failure of one, the other barriers will contain the leakage of radioactivity. And this is also a feature of all reactors all over the world. Next slide. This is a picture of the two reactors with their containment structures in the Rajasthan Atomic Power Station on the Chambal River. This is a picture of the two reactors at the Madras Atomic Power Station. I showed you the turbine system and the generator system. Now, after the steam delivers its energy, there are various ways it can be cooled. In the case of the Rajasthan station, it is cooled by the river water in a once-through system. The Madras Atomic Power Station, that steam is brought to condensation by seawater cooling. We draw seawater as the coolant from the sea, and the cooled condensed steam is recycled in the system because we don't have a source of fresh water here. And these are the recently commissioned reactors at Kakrapar near Surat. Here also there is a source of fresh water, but not an unlimited supply. So there are cooling towers to dissipate the heat in the cooling water, and the water requirement is confined, limited to the makeup water. So you saw three different types. One where you draw cooling water for the condenser from the river in a once-through system. One where you draw from the sea. The third, again, fresh water, but as it is limited in source, you cool it in a cooling tower. Next slide. I will very briefly refer to the two other possibilities. We talked so far of uranium-235, mentioned about plutonium, but the larger isotope that is available in nature is uranium-238. Over 99% of natural uranium is 238. But when it is placed in a reactor and is exposed to neutrons, it gets converted into an entirely new element not available in nature, that's plutonium-239. And this again is a nuclear fuel that can be used the same way as uranium-235, and that is what is being used in a new generation of reactors we have started in Kalpakkam, that is called the breeder reactor. Then also thorium-232, which is a naturally occurring source, again by itself is not a nuclear fuel, but it can be converted to uranium-233, which again is a fissionable material. And this also can be used as a fuel in a nuclear power system. So we have got two abundant sources other than the naturally occurring uranium-235, the more abundant uranium-238 and much more abundant thorium-232, which are relevant to the Indian program. Next slide. Now this is a comparison of our various energy sources. Coal, estimated at about 90 billion tons, where we are drawing now, can set up a 500,000 megawatt capacity of electricity, which can last us for 70 years in the next century. There is a hydro resource of 60,000 megawatt, but not all of it is easily accessible. We have harnessed about 15 or 20% of this resource. You know the problems in building large dams. The natural uranium resource, mainly the uranium-235, can sustain a power generation of 15,000 megawatts for 30 years. The uranium-238 converted to plutonium can expand that capacity to 350 for 65 years, comparable to our coal resource. And when we have spent the uranium resource, we have much larger resource in thorium, which can support even a much larger capacity for two or three centuries. So in the Indian Atomic Energy Program, the strategy is to start with the natural uranium as we have done in the first line of stations, separate the plutonium to use it in the breeder reactors, and side by side develop the thorium resource. So that shows the three-phase strategy of the first generation reactors that I showed for you, where in the operation you discharge plutonium and also the depleted uranium. Then you have the second generation reactors fueled with plutonium, which also produce power and more plutonium. And the third generation that will be fueled by uranium-233. This was the very first research reactor that was commissioned in Trombay, Apsara, in 1956. Our first experience in reactor construction and commissioning. This reactor has operated now for 40 years and was the first source of radioisotopes. These are two other larger reactors also in Trombay, the Canada-India reactor built with Canadian collaboration, and the R5 Dhruva reactor, larger than this. And both are used not only for neutron physics experiments, but also for producing radioisotopes for a variety of applications. This is the research center itself, other than the reactors, where you have got the long laboratory building and then the engineering halls, where all the science and technology work preparatory to industrial activity is done. And I thought I will, towards the end, illustrate some of the applications of radiation. For example, yesterday I saw a news item, this season we are having a glut of potatoes and onions. We are worried. Now, radiation can increase the shelf life. This is one where an untreated charge of potatoes, you can see the molding. This is one where it has been treated with radiation. You don't see any signs of molding. Next slide. Similarly, these are the irradiated onions that gives the measure of the radiation. And these are the ones sprouting. They have done extensive work in Trombay on the use of radiation to produce new mutants. This is a sample of a groundnut mutant where not only the yield, the pod is high, they also have groundnuts with associated leaves, which are important as cattle fodder. Like the firefly, the radioisotope is a tracer. It carries its own tag. And here is an example where a pipeline which has been welded and laid in position is being tested for leaks. In a long pipeline, if you circulate through the pipe a solution with a minor amount of radioactive tracer, wherever there is a leak, you can identify the leak because of the radioactivity. Next slide. Radiation is also being used for sterilization of medical products. We have a unit in Trombay, we have a unit in Bangalore, and this is a teletherapy cobalt source for radiotherapy of cancer patients. And of course, that's the picture of Dr. Baba, who had the courage to launch a program as far back as 1944, who had the courage to visualize that in this field of advanced technology, India can make and sustain a start. I will show only one last projection. Mentioned about various public perceptions regarding nuclear energy. One, of course, is the common perception that there is no difference between the reactor and the bomb. Now, I've explained to you that for designing a bomb, you have to have a system where the energy release is achieved in a millionth of a second by a special trigger device, while in the reactor system, as I've explained, it's a distributed fuel loading where there is a continuous cooling to keep the fuel temperature down. And also the excess, there is a considerable excess reactivity in the bomb because you want to achieve the maximum release of energy. Here that excess reactivity is very minimal. Various other aspects that a reactor cannot explode like a bomb. In fact, in the Chernobyl accident, where there was a lot of uranium in the reactor, the pressure release was equivalent to a few kilograms of TNT, unlike the kilotons of TNT we saw in the case of the Hiroshima bomb. Of course, in the public mind, both in the United States and the former Soviet Union, there is the memory of the two accidents. Then atomic radiation is considered as mysterious, invisible, it entails large health risks. The fact is radiation, it can be measured, and we have got known technology to shield the operating personnel and also the surrounding population, keep the exposure to the minimum. And I mentioned that radioactivity was discovered in 1896. So we have a knowledge of radioactivity for 100 years. Radiation sources were used from the earliest times for diagnostics and treatment, particularly for treatment. But over 100 years, we know now how to safely handle radiation. Then the oft-raised question, what about the waste? I mentioned about all the fission products which are radioactive. It will stay radioactive for about 300 years. It is considered unfair that a present generation hands over a liability to future generations. But again, we have a technology to concentrate, to isolate and concentrate this waste in the form of a glass that can be stored away and can be kept under observation. The technology is available. It is not as though it's an unsolved problem. And there is also the fond belief that why are we battling with these problems? Solar should be safer, wind should be safer, but it's not as though work has not been done on these approaches, but their contribution to the total energy situation is still very small. I think I will stop here and I'll be glad to answer questions.
So I already welcome all of you back to the world of reality from the world of atoms. So, respected Professor CVS and friends, in recent years, a peculiar tendency is growing up among the Indians. Everybody has started to speak about the nuclear policy of this country without knowing what the nucleus is. But unlike most of them, Professor CVS is one among the rare personalities of India who can speak not only about the nuclear policy but also about the nuclear physics. Authority-wise. Hitherto, we have had a nice, informative and provocative session with Professor CVS. On the behalf of all the participants of this course, I extend my cordial thanks to Professor CVS. Thank you very much, sir. And these types of sessions are the essential and integral parts of this type of course. So, I thank the authorities of NIAS for arranging this type of lecture. Thank you.